2016. Okay, so we'll start with the homage to the Buddha. Is this thing too loud? The sound, is it too loud? Okay, so we'll start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today I said we will take two suttas, and this time I promise that we will cover both suttas. Because the first one is the one that I skipped over a few weeks ago, so we'll come back to that. And this is very short, just 3 pages, and it's a lot of repetition and very simple. Okay, so this is called the Nagara Vindeya Sutta. It's sutta number 150 in the Middle Length Discourses, beginning on page 1140. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha has been wandering in the state of Kosala, and he comes to a village named Nagaravinda. Okay, then apparently it's a Brahmin village, and so it says that the Brahmin householders of Nagaravinda heard that the Buddha has come to them, and then they decide to come to see him. And so they go to the Buddha, some pay homage, some just do the anjali, respectful salutation, others exchange greetings with him, and some just sit down silently on one side. Okay, then the people of Nagaravinda ask the Buddha a question. So he says, I'm sorry. The Buddha addresses them and says, householders, if wanderers of other sects ask you this, what kind of recluses and Brahmins should not be honored, respected, revered, and venerated, you should answer them thus. Before we come to the answer, I just have to fill in a little bit about the background to the time of the Buddha. So I've gone through this before, but in the Buddha's time, there was a large, very, very diverse communities, a large number with very, very diverse communities of ascetics and Brahmin wanderers, Brahmins who did not live the household life but belonged to renunciate communities. And there was a great diversity in the philosophies that underlie these different sects of ascetics, different types of spiritual practices. And so for an observer on the Indian scene of that time, it would have been very, very confusing to know who is truly holy and worthy of veneration. Like there would be some ascetics who would just let their hair grow very, very long, never cutting it, and then they would put it up on the top of their heads in a coil on top of the head with long flowing beards. Others would have their hair in matted locks. Others, of course, would shave the hair and beard. Some would be wearing ochre robes or orange-colored robes similar to this. Others wore white robes. Others went around completely, some with just loincloths. Others completely naked. Some would cover the bodies with ashes. Yeah, if you want to get some idea of what India might have been like in the Buddha's time, you could actually see it on YouTube. I'm not saying this jokingly. There is a festival that takes place in India every 12 years. It's called the Kumbh Mela. So you can search for this on YouTube. It takes place every 12 years at a particular auspicious astrological conjunction or astrological configuration. I think it comes in the middle of February, but I'm not so sure. Probably the full moon in the month of February. At Allahabad, it's the place where the Ganges, and I think it's the Yamuna River, meet. And it's considered to be an extremely sort of auspicious place, a holy place. And when the Kumbh Mela takes place, all the different ascetics, sannyasis, swamis, renunciants, Brahmins from all over India come and they converge for the Kumbh Mela. And so you could see what all of the different great variety of sects would have been like in the time of the Buddha. And the big feature in the Kumbh Mela is that the naked ascetics, they're called Nagas. You see, what takes place at the Kumbh Mela at exactly the right astrological time, everybody is supposed to go into the Ganges River to bathe, to take a dip in the Ganges, because that's exactly at that moment, that's the time when one is supposed to be able to wash off all of one's past sins and impurities and get many blessings from the Ganges. And the ones who lead the descent into the Ganges are the Nagas, the naked ascetics. Usually they live in the Himalayan mountains, but they come down especially for this very auspicious event. When I saw it on YouTube, I thought maybe I would like to see what that's like in person. But I think the last one was held in 2014, and it's held once every 12 years. And so when the next one takes place, I'll be in my 80s. I don't know whether I could take it. Yeah, and of all of these different sects, probably the most outrageous from our point of view is a sect, I think they're called the Kapatikas. It's one of the branches of the naked ascetics. Their specialty is to flaunt all the conventional rules and expectations of decent behavior. And so, of course, they go naked, they'll shout at people, abuse them, not because they're angry, but it's a way to, you know, to express their particular vision of the world. And the idea is to get people to retaliate and strike back at you, so then you can practice developing equanimity towards those situations, towards provocative situations. And another of their practices is to live in cemeteries and cremation grounds. I think they carry a skull with the top cut off, and they use the skull as their begging bowl, so they collect their food in the top of the skull and eat out of the skull. And then they go to they go to sleep at night in the cemetery cremation ground, and they say that they even eat excrement. But there's very, very deep philosophy underlying this. You see, the underlying philosophical vision is that everything is Brahman, that is, the divine. Like, everything is the ultimate spiritual reality. So if everything is the ultimate divine reality, then how do we distinguish, I like my nice rice and curries prepared with delicious spices, but I don't like to eat excrement. I'll sleep in a nice bed, but I'm afraid of the sleep in the cemetery. I like to be praised and spoken to politely, but I don't like other people to abuse me. But if one really has a highly developed mind, one should be able to regard everything the same. And if one regards everything the same, then one should be able to act on the basis of that spiritual vision. And that's why you can do everything that the worldly convention regards as being taboo, prohibited, repulsive. One does it. And breaking down these false discriminations, false distinctions, and in that way, the belief is that you could realize the divine, ultimate reality of everything. For myself, I don't think I need that deep philosophy. I'll take just a simpler point of view. Okay, so anyway, when people observe all of these different ascetics and renunciants and sannyasis with their different garments, the different outfits, different appearances, different practices, the question comes, which one of these are really holy and saintly, and which are just deluded or even humbug, putting on humbug? And so just like that, a question can arise in the mind of an Indian villager today, it would have arisen in the minds of Indian people back in the days of the Buddha. So they want to know what kind of ascetics and Brahmins should not be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. And then the Buddha gives them the answer. And he says, those recluses and Brahmins who are not rid of lust, hate, and delusion regarding forms cognizable by the eye, whose minds are not inwardly peaceful, and who conduct themselves now righteously, now unrighteously, in body, speech, and mind. So these ascetics and Brahmins should not be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. And why is that? And this is the way the householders should think. Because we ourselves are not rid of lust, hate, and delusion regarding forms cognizable by the eye. Our minds are not inwardly peaceful, and we conduct ourselves now righteously, now unrighteously, in body, speech, and mind. And so we do not see any higher righteous conduct on the part of those good recluses and Brahmins. So they should not be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. Okay, then the same thing is repeated for each of the other sense modalities. Okay, then comes the positive side. So if wanderers of other sects ask you, householders, what kind of recluses and Brahmins should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated, you should answer them thus. And it's interesting here that the Buddha doesn't say you should tell them we think it's the disciples of the recluse Gotama of the Buddha who should be honored, revered, and venerated. So the Buddha is not setting up a criterion. You know, these are my disciples, therefore you should honor and venerate them. But rather he's setting out, you might call this an objective set of criteria. And so he says, the answer is that those recluses and Brahmins who are rid of lust, hate, and delusion regarding forms cognizable by the eye, whose minds are inwardly peaceful, and who conduct themselves righteously in body, speech, and mind, such recluses and Brahmins should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. And it strikes me here, though I don't think even the commentary says this, the text doesn't say it, but it seems that these criteria set out here could be distinguished in terms of the three trainings in moral conduct, samadhi or concentration, and wisdom, though here they would appear in reverse order. So we say that those ascetics and Brahmins who are rid of lust, hate, and delusion regarding forms cognizable by the eye, since it's the function of wisdom to cut off lust, hatred, and delusion, so we'd say that this represents the training in wisdom. And then whose minds are inwardly peaceful, and since it's the task of the training in samadhi, or concentration, to make the mind calm and peaceful, we could say that this implies the training in samadhi. And then the third phrase that's used, who conduct themselves righteously in body, speech, and mind, those are the marks or characteristics of good behavior or ethical behavior. And so this can be taken to represent the training in sila, in virtuous behavior. Okay, so these are the recluses and Brahmins who should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. And so setting up as the highest standard those who have, who have completed the three trainings in virtue, concentration, and wisdom. But also, though the sutta doesn't, at this point, it doesn't say that explicitly, but I would also say that those should be venerated, at least in a provisional way, who are engaged in the training in good behavior, samadhi, and wisdom, even if they haven't perfected those trainings. So, for example, you might see Buddhist monks and nuns. Sometimes, you know, the behavior, it's not perfect. They have their human faults. But you shouldn't bring in this text and then say, ah, so I see some traces. This one likes a little, eats a bit too much, so they're not free of greed. This one gets angry from time to time. This one seems to be a little bit restless. This one, their behavior is a little bit off, and therefore they're not worthy of respect. But if you know that they've actually undertaken the training in sila, samadhi, and punya, and are at least most of the time engaged in that training, then you should consider that indeed that they are worthy of respect. Not yet the highest veneration, but as renunciants who have undertaken a spiritual discipline, then you should consider they're worthy of respect. And also I would say the same goes to ascetics, priests, monks from other spiritual traditions. Don't think only the Buddhist monks and nuns are worthy of respect, but those who have undertaken any kind of training that helps to cultivate conduct and to develop the good qualities of the mind. Okay, so what is the reason why these ascetics and Brahmins are worthy of veneration and respect? And this is the way they reflect, because we ourselves are not rid of lust, hate, and delusion regarding forms cognizable by the eye. Our minds are not inwardly peaceful, and we conduct ourselves sometimes righteously, sometimes unrighteously, in body, speech, and mind. And since we see higher righteous conduct on the part of those good recluses and Brahmins, they should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. Okay, then, you know, basically the same pattern is repeated, or the same passage is repeated for each of the other sense modalities. Okay, so then we come to paragraph 6. Okay, if wanderers of other sects ask you, what are your reasons and what is your evidence regarding those venerable ones, whereby you say about them, surely those venerable ones are either rid of lust or are practicing for the removal of lust, either rid of hate or are practicing for the removal of hate, either rid of delusion or are practicing for the removal of delusion. You see, here the statement has a wider scope than the previous one, whereas the previous one says that those who are worthy of respect are those who have eliminated lust, hate, and delusion. Here it says either those who have eliminated them or those who are practicing for the elimination of them. Okay, so what is your evidence for making this claim? And so this is the answer that should be given. It is because those venerable ones resort to remote jungle thicket resting places, or dwelling places in the forest. For there are no forms cognizable by the eye there of a kind that they could look at and delight in. No sounds cognizable by the ear, no odors cognizable by the nose, no flavors cognizable by the tongue, no tactile or textures cognizable by the body that they could touch and delight in. These are our reasons, that is our evidence, why we say that surely these venerable ones are either rid of lust, hate, and delusion, or are practicing for their removal. It's a little narrow, the scope of this particular passage, in that there are monastics who are not always living, you know, in remote forest dwelling places, but also they can be living in villages, towns, cities, and still practicing for the removal of lust, hate, and delusion. But still, there's a big difference between living in the forest or the countryside and living in the middle of the city. Just yesterday, I had to go into New York City to see a dentist, and I mean, the contrast between being here and being taking the Metro North into Grand Central Station and then having to get onto the subway at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 3:30 in the afternoon, streams of people coming by, so that it's almost difficult to move from one point to another. Okay, so then when the Buddha gives this answer, then the householders of Nagaravinda say, "Magnificent Master Gotama, Magnificent Master Gotama." Then they go for refuge to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, to the Sangha. Okay, so that is the sutta. Are there any questions or comments? Wait, take the microphone.
I was questioning going into the remote jungle thicket and not having any kind of pleasures. I would find even the sun on my back would be a pleasure, or listening to the birds. I know there would be fearful things going on there, but there are some pleasures there.
People
pay a lot of money to go and find.
Actually, it is quite pleasant living in the forest.
Yeah.
Of course, you do get beautiful forest scenery.
Uh-huh.
And as you say, the singing of the birds. And when the trees are flowering, there can be the breezes bringing the sweet scents from the wildflowers and flowers in the trees. But those are what I would call pure pleasures. They're not the pleasures that provoke, even though they come through the senses, but they're not the pleasures that provoke lust.
Okay. So like if I'm in my own yard and it's really pretty, I'm still kind of greedy and clinging to it. But if I go into the woods or the jungle, there's really nothing much you can cling to there other than, you can't think about it too much. You can just appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But really, the basis of clinging is the mind rather than the objective environment. So while living in the forest is more congenial to renunciation and detachment.
True.
But as long as there is the disposition to clinging, the mind can find something, anything to cling to.
But I think less so in the jungle.
Less so, but what I found to be particularly the case with monks living in forest monasteries, the clinging attaches itself to particular ways of doing things. So one monk might have a preferred routine of doing things in a particular way, and then say if the abbot of the forest monastery decides to change the routine, and one is attached to a particular schedule for arranging one's daily activities, and the routine is changed, then there comes a resistance to that, and it provokes anger. I was told that Achan Cha, though I didn't live with Achan Cha, I was not his pupil in any way, but I was told that he would regularly change the schedule at his monastery so that the monks, this is what I heard from a French monk who had lived with Achan Cha, he told me that they all got comfortable to knowing that this was the time where you do your morning chanting, then you have your morning meditation this period, you have a certain free time, you can do your yoga or do your reading, whatever. So they would get sort of comfortably settled into that routine and taking it for granted. Then Achan Cha would come out one day and say, okay, now we're going to do the morning chanting at this time. And we'll have a work period during my yoga period. And then it would set all of the monks, or at least some of them, their minds would go into a state of agitation. How are we going to deal with this? And it would be the purpose of Achan Cha was to reflect back to the monks the way that they had become attached to particular routines.
Less of a sense of self in the jungle also that could promote
peaceful
thinking.
The sense of self, of course, can thrive anywhere.
Yeah.
And that sense of self, it sort of manifests itself in the form of this clinging to preferred routines.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, Tina.
Take
the microphone.
I'm sorry to be off the topic a little, but you talked about the Nagas. And at the end of our class, we always chant and we bless the Nagas.
Yeah.
I'm interested, is that the same Nagas?
No, it's a different word.
Oh, it is?
Oh, yeah.
How would you spell it? Do you spell it differently, or it's a...
I'm not sure how to... The Naga, which are the dragon spirits, that is the N long...
N-A-G-A?
No. Yeah, but the first A is the long A. The Naga, who are the ascetics, it might be spelled the same way, but I think it must be a different word. I assume is a different word. And I think the original word could have been in Sanskrit, Nagga, N-A-G-G-A, which is related, you could see the connection with the English word naked. You know, basically it comes from the same origins. But I think the word Nag, the old Sanskrit word Nagga, it might have gotten conflated with the word Naga, you know, meaning the dragon spirits. And so now they call them Nagas with the long A. But they're not the same thing by any means. Okay, then... Oh, Tsering. Yeah.
Bhante, is going back to your questions on the practice of these yogis coming on that event where all the yogis come, and their practice of unconventional things like...
Some aren't. Most of them are quite conventional, but there are some who...
Very unconventional.
Yeah.
Now, in the Buddhist, we have practices to get rid of hatred, desire, and illusions. Doesn't those yogis' practices also lead towards that?
I would say that they're aiming for that. Though maybe they have a different, you know, that they conceive, particularly delusion or ignorance, they will conceive differently, and so they'll conceive wisdom differently. But certainly the more moderate yogis and sannyasis are also aiming in some way at overcoming greed, hatred, and delusion.
Right, Bhante. Thank you.
I'm not sure I understand this passage, only that in that shouldn't the mind training that the Buddha is teaching, it's uprooting these sort of defilements within the mind, so shouldn't they work irrespective of the physical location one is in?
I didn't quite... Say again.
What I don't understand about this passage is that it's saying that these sages should be revered because they're in a place that essentially offers no temptation.
Yeah.
Rather than saying, well, if one trains the mind, one's uprooting these defilements irrespective of one's location.
Yeah.
So I'm confused about the path.
You know, that there are different... This is interesting, that there are different perspectives that come through in the Buddhist text. Like, there are some passages where the Buddha says that it doesn't matter whether one is living in the forest or in the village, that one should still be training the mind to overcome greed, hatred, and delusion. But still, I say that the majority of passages advocate the forest as a more ideal place, a more suitable place, especially for undertaking the practice of meditation, because it's remote from... You know, a lot of activities, a lot of sensory provocative phenomena, and it's quiet. It's a quiet place, silent place, and so it's more congenial to the practice. Okay, I want to move on to the other sutta now. At least reach the end of the Majjhima Nikaya, even though there are a couple of suttas we have to go back to. Okay, this sutta is called The Development of the Faculties. And I think this will lead almost into corroborating the point that... What was your name again? Anna? Okay, that Anna just made. Okay, so this sutta is called the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, number 152, and the title means the development of the faculties. Okay, and the sutta takes place when the Buddha is living at Kajangala. It's a place very seldom mentioned in the texts, in a grove of mukelu trees. Okay, then a Brahmin student named Uttara, who's a pupil of an elder Brahmin named Parasarya, comes to the Buddha and exchanges greetings with him. And then the Buddha asks this young Brahmin student, does the Brahmin Parasarya teach his disciples the development of the faculties? And Uttara says he does, and then the Buddha asks, how does he teach his disciples the development of the faculties? And then Uttara says that he teaches in this way, that one shouldn't see forms with the eye, and one shouldn't hear sounds with the ears. Okay, then the Buddha argues against him and says, if that is the case, Uttara, then a blind man and a deaf man will have developed faculties, because a blind man doesn't see forms with the eyes, and a deaf man doesn't hear sounds with the ear. Okay, when the Buddha says this, then Uttara feels dismayed and he sits glum and without response. Okay, then the Buddha addresses the Venerable Ananda and he says that the Brahmin Parasarya teaches his disciples the development of the faculties in one way, but in the Noble One's discipline, the supreme development of the faculties is otherwise or different. Okay, so the key expression here, and it's a rather unusual expression because I don't recall seeing an expression like this elsewhere in the suttas. Usually we have the expression Indriya Sangvara, which means the restraint of the faculties, the restraint of the sense faculties. And when the Buddha speaks about developing the faculties, then elsewhere he speaks about development of the five spiritual faculties. But here he's speaking about the development of the faculties with regard to the sense faculties. Okay, so now the Venerable Ananda speaks up and says, now is the time for you to teach the supreme development of the faculties in the Noble One's discipline. Okay, so the Buddha says, now you should listen, I'm going to speak. And then he starts to speak. And I have to confess that the passage that comes here, I find a bit problematic and I don't fully understand it, so I'm not going to claim to be able to speak authoritatively about it. So let's go through it and then I'll show you where I find it problematic. Okay, so the Buddha says, how is there how is there the supreme development of the faculties in the Noble One's discipline? Okay, when a monk sees a form with the eye, there arises in him what is agreeable, there arises what is disagreeable, there arises what is both agreeable and disagreeable. Okay, now the words here in Pali are usually, these two words, manapa is what is agreeable. It's based on mana, which is the mind, that which is pleasing to the mind. And umanapa is what is disagreeable, what is displeasing to the mind. And almost everywhere else in the text that I'm, so far as I know, those are qualities of the objects that appear. Whereas here, it seems, when we take the whole sutta, at least in some parts of it, it seems to be referring to the reactions to the objects rather than to the objects themselves. Okay, so the text says, okay, there arises in him what is agreeable, what is disagreeable, what is both agreeable and disagreeable. That is, what is agreeable in some respects, disagreeable in other respects. So he understands thus, there has arisen in me what is agreeable, there has arisen what is disagreeable, there has arisen what is both agreeable and disagreeable. Now you see, when it speaks about the arising of what is agreeable, disagreeable, both agreeable and disagreeable, it seems to be referring not to the objects, but to some kind of reaction or response to the object. And that seems very unusual, perhaps even unique to this sutta. And I think the commentary, or is it the Tika? Yes, the commentary, and this is in note 1353, the commentary explains that when a desirable form comes into range of the eye, an agreeable state arises. When an undesirable form appears, a disagreeable state arises. When an indifferent form appears, a state that is both agreeable and disagreeable arises. And then it should be noted that though these three terms are ordinarily used to qualify the sense objects, here they also seem to signify subtle states of liking, aversion, and dull indifference that arise due to the influence of the underlying tendencies. And then the sub-commentary, that's the Tika, identifies the agreeable with wholesome and unwholesome states of mind associated with joy, the disagreeable with unwholesome states of mind associated with grief or displeasure, and the agreeable and disagreeable with states of mind associated with neutral feeling, with equanimous feeling. Okay, but later, when we come to the last section of the sutta, we'll see that there's some evidence that those three terms should not be identified with liking, disliking, and dull indifference, because they also occur in the arhat, who's free of liking, disliking, and dull indifference. Okay, anyway, so this is the way the monk who's training in the Noble One's discipline is instructed to deal with them. So he understands these states have arisen. Then one contemplates, this is conditioned. arising through a number of conditions. It's gross, since it's a coarse sensory experience. It's dependently arisen, almost synonymous with conditioned, arising in dependence on conditions. Okay, but this is peaceful, this is sublime, that is equanimity. So here, equanimity, it seems, it's being opposed to what is agreeable, disagreeable, and both agreeable and disagreeable. So since equanimity is a balanced state of mind, then it seems that the agreeable and disagreeable are unbalanced states of mind. So that would support the understanding as being liking and disliking. Okay, so when he reflects in that way, then the agreeable that arose, the disagreeable that arose, and the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose cease, and equanimity is established. Again, this supports the idea of the agreeable and disagreeable as being liking and disliking, because the object doesn't cease. The object is still there, but what is agreeable and disagreeable cease. And so that would be the liking and disliking for the object. And they're replaced by equanimity, so that in the face of things which are agreeable, objects that are agreeable, that are pleasant, enjoyable, delightful, one doesn't get swept away by liking for them. And in the face of objects that are disagreeable, that are displeasing, disruptive, disturbing, one doesn't experience dislike for them, but one can maintain equanimity. Okay, then the Buddha illustrates each of the sense modalities with its own distinct simile. So here he uses the simile of a man with good sight, having opened his eyes, might shut them, or having shut his eyes, might open them. So concerning anything at all, in the same way, the agreeable, the disagreeable, the both agreeable and disagreeable, they cease just as quickly, just as rapidly, just as easily, and equanimity is established. And so here, opening and shutting the eyes, that is illustrates the speed with which one is able to dispel the liking and disliking and replace them with equanimity. And so the key here is reflecting on whatever arises, agreeable or disagreeable, or both, reflecting upon it as being conditioned, arisen through conditions, dependently arisen. And so in that way, one is not drawn towards what is enjoyable or likable. One is not repelled by what is repulsive, disturbing. Maybe this was the practice undertaken by those Kapatika ascetics who lived in cemeteries and would eat the flesh of corpses and excrement. It's just conditioned phenomena. Okay, so that is the way the practice is undertaken with regard to forms visible through the eye. Now with sounds, again, the practice is the same, but the simile is different here. Here the simile is given that just as a strong man might easily snap his fingers, so with the snap of a finger, just, it just takes a split second, And so in the same way, by reflecting in this way, one can dispel the liking and disliking that arise and establish equanimity. But that speed, I have to point out, is the product of long and disciplined training. It doesn't come just immediately by reflecting, that is condition, gross, dependently arisen. But one uses that reflection at first with some effort, struggle, inner conflict, firm determination, and then over time, as one develops mental skill of mind and mental momentum, a built-up momentum of force in the mind, then one is able to apply that reflection and dispel the liking and disliking on the spot. Okay, then we have the same pattern as repeated for smelling and odor with the nose, but here a different simile is used, that of raindrops falling on a lotus leaf. And so when the raindrops fall on the lotus leaf, they immediately just roll down and fall off. And then in regard to tastes or flavors, that one can taste with the tongue. The simile is that, I don't know why a strong man is necessary, but any person can do it, could easily spit out a ball of spittle collected on the tip of the tongue. I don't want to illustrate the speed with which one could do that here. But you could do it very quickly. And so in the same way, one, in a sense, spits out the liking and disliking that arose. And then in regard to tactile objects or textures that one experiences through the sense of touch, the simile is that of a strong man who might extend his bent-in arm or might bend his extended arm. So too, one could eliminate any kind of a liking or disliking that arise. And then in regard to mind objects cognizable by the mind, the simile is given of, suppose one were to let, I like this simile, it makes a very strong impression. It's like you have a hot plate, you know, a pan on a stove, and it's very, very hot, and you let two or three drops of water fall onto the hot iron plate, and immediately they would vaporize with a hissing sound. It says that the falling of the drops might be slow, but they would quickly vaporize and vanish. And it occurred to me that this idea of the drops falling slowly, but then quickly vaporizing, it occurred to me, maybe that is stated in regard to the mind objects, because in the case of sense objects, they're grosser, and so when they impinge on the sense, then as soon as one adverts to them, one could immediately dispel them. But mind objects, that is like thoughts, images, ideas, reflections, because they're occurring inwardly, they might persist a little longer, but when one adverts to them, then one can bring that mental force to dispel them. Okay, so this takes us through the six sense modalities, and then the Buddha concludes this part of the sutta by saying, in the Noble One's discipline, this is called the supreme development. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. It should be the very last sentence on the page. So that is how there is the supreme development of the faculties in the Noble One's discipline. And since the next passage is going to deal with the disciple in the higher training, and the last passage with the arahat, I would infer that this passage pertains to a disciple who is still technically what we call a worldling, who's not yet reached any stage of realization, but is training in order to reach the very first stage of realization. So this is also a disciple in training, but not yet one who has reached the higher training. Okay, of course, it's with the next passage on paragraph 10 that we have the one who is called the disciple in higher training. And this is the term that's used here is seka. This term refers to a disciple who has reached at least the stage of the path, who has reached at least the path to stream entry. And it goes up to the disciple who is on the path to arhatship, but has not yet realized the fruit of arhatship. And so one on the path of stream entry, according to the text, is bound to reach the fruit of stream entry within that life itself. And once one reaches the path of stream entry, then one is bound to reach the final goal, arhatship, within 7 more existences. And so when one becomes a seka, a disciple in higher training, then one is irreversibly on the path to liberation. One can never fall back again. Okay, so here the question comes, okay, so how is one a disciple in higher training, one who has entered upon the way, entered upon the path? So what is the way in which the disciple in higher training practices the development of the faculties? Okay, so then the answer comes, when a bhikkhu sees a form with the eye, hears a sound with the ear, smells an odor, tastes a flavor, touches a tactile sensation, cognizes a mind object with the mind, there arises in him what is agreeable, what is disagreeable, what is both agreeable and disagreeable. Okay, so here, taking these terms in the sense of liking, disliking, and this dull indifference would work, because the disciple in higher training is not yet free from greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay, but then it says he is repelled, humiliated, and disgusted by that agreeable that arose, by the disagreeable that arose, and by both the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose. Okay, now the text, the note says, although the seka has entered upon the way to final liberation, he is still prone to subtle states of liking, aversion, and dull indifference in regard to sense objects. He experiences them, however, as impediments to progress and thus becomes repelled by them. Okay, in this case, as I said, agreeable, disagreeable will work as liking and disliking. But the idea of being repelled, humiliated, disgusted, one doesn't become repelled, humiliated, and disgusted by the sense objects that appear, because they're bound to appear to anybody. And so the idea of becoming repelled, humiliated, disgusted, those are rather strong words in English, but I think the Pali doesn't have quite the same nuance as these English words. But there comes a kind of, let's say that there comes a resistance to those unwholesome states that arise and the desire to get rid of them, to eliminate them. And it only works if one takes them as being the inner subjective states, not the objects. Because likable objects will arise for anybody. I see beautiful forms. When I go into New York, when I'm on the subway train, beautiful, some young beautiful women will appear. So I see them naturally. And I'll hear the grating sounds of, you know, the train and people yelling and shouting. That will come naturally. If I get unpleasant food, I'll get an unpleasant taste. If I get delicious food, I'll get delicious taste. So that will come naturally. But the resistance comes not to the objects, but to the unwholesome reactions to them. Okay, so that is how one is a disciple in higher training, one who has entered upon the path. Okay, now we come to the last section, and that is, how is one a noble one with developed faculties? And the Pali uses the word Arya Bhavitindriya, and this is clearly the Arahat, referring to the Arahat, the one who's completed the practice of the path. Okay, and so the text says, "Here, Ananda, when a bhikkhu sees a form with the eye, hears a sound with the ear, and so on, there arises in him what is agreeable, there arises what is disagreeable, there arises what is both agreeable and disagreeable." Okay, this is where I say that the idea of taking the agreeable and disagreeable as being liking and disliking, or greed and aversion, wouldn't work, because this is the Arahat who has eradicated greed, hatred, and delusion. And so here it would seem that the agreeable, disagreeable, and both agreeable and disagreeable would take on their normal meaning as referring to qualities of the object. Okay, now the Buddha explains a particular practice that can be undertaken. Well, it can be undertaken by anybody, but it's brought to perfection. This practice is brought to perfection by the Arahat. Okay, so this is the way the special practice goes. If he should wish, may I abide perceiving the unrepulsive in the repulsive, he abides perceiving the unrepulsive in the repulsive. Okay, this is a bit abstruse the way it's expressed in Pali, but the way it's explained, the commentary makes the meaning clear. So it explains that this type of mental skill can be developed towards both persons and towards inanimate objects. In terms of persons, what's called the repulsive would be hostile people, people who are aggressive, abusive, disagreeable, oppressive, disturbing, or who might be disturbing. So towards that type of person, one develops the meditation on loving kindness or the meditation on compassion. And then when one develops the meditation on loving kindness towards that person, the aggressive, hostile person, then that person ceases to be, or one doesn't perceive that person as repulsive, but rather one starts to relate to that person, to experience that person as a friend. And so one can feel deep kindness, loving concern for that person. And if the person is acting in unwholesome and abusive ways, one could feel compassion for that person. And so towards that person, by developing loving kindness and compassion, the repulsive becomes unrepulsive. And then towards repulsive, inanimate objects, like disagreeable forms, it could be disagreeable forms, sounds, odors, tastes, and so on, one does the contemplation in terms of the elements. One contemplates that these are just, if it's material objects, just material phenomena consisting, composed of the four great elements arising through conditions, and then one ceases to be repelled by them. And so if there's disagreeable food, you know, one doesn't like the food, but there's nothing else to eat, one eats it and just contemplates, this is just, you know, substance made up of the four elements with quality of taste, and so one is able to eat the disagreeable food. If one is seeing disagreeable forms, one contemplates, these forms are just made up based on objects made of, consisting of the four elements which present certain forms. And so when one just contemplates bare visible forms in the seeing, just what is seen, in the heard, just what is heard, then one is no longer projecting the ideas of repulsive upon them, and they just will present themselves as neutral. Okay, so in that way, there is, one is able to perceive the repulsive as unrepulsive. Okay, then there is, one abides perceiving the unrepulsive. I think I lost track. May I abide perceiving the repulsive in the unrepulsive. Okay, this is, seems to be the mirror opposite of it, but it's actually just another skill in the development of perception. So in this case, we have the unrepulsive or the attractive can apply to both persons and inanimate objects. So in regard to persons, and this is the training for the monk, it's particularly would be sensually attractive objects, probably particularly sexually attractive objects. And so the way that's taught to perceive the repulsive in the attractive, or to perceive the attractive as repulsive, is to do the contemplation on the nature of the body, that is the contemplation on the constituents of the body. And so normally, you know, with untrained minds, we think the body is beautiful and attractive, lovely. She has such a nice manner of walking, such beautiful flowing hair, such a sweet smile. But one takes that form of the body and starts analyzing what is actually present, what is there. And one sees it's a combination of, the text mentioned, the 32 unattractive parts. Okay, you look at the hair and you really take the hairs separately. Not very attractive. The hairs of the body, not attractive. The fingernails, the teeth, the skin, sort of peel it off from the body. Nothing very beautiful there. Then look beneath the skin, there's muscle, sinews, bones, the marrow of the bones, then the different organs and tissues and fluids and excretions. And so that beautiful and attractive body becomes just an assemblage of unattractive parts. So in that way, one develops a kind of disenchantment towards the body. And then in regard to beautiful and attractive inanimate objects, nice forms, beautiful sounds, beautiful smells, and so on, again, one applies the contemplation in terms of the elements, or the contemplation as impermanent, that it arises and passes away. It's dependent on conditions, and when the conditions stop, the thing arisen will stop. And in that way, one develops a kind of equanimity towards the attractive sensory objects. Okay, then the third, may I abide perceiving the unrepulsive in the repulsive and the unrepulsive. Let me rephrase that in a way which is maybe more immediately intelligible. May I perceive what is both attractive and may I perceive what is both attractive and repulsive as lovable. Okay, so this involves okay, in this case, one applies the first and second contemplations. I'm just reading from the note because my mind is getting a little convoluted, lost in the convolutions here. One applies the first and second contemplations to both repulsive and unrepulsive objects. Okay, let's move on to the fifth method. So the fifth is that one, may I avoid both the repulsive and the unrepulsive and abide in equanimity, mindful and fully aware. So in this method, one just withdraws the mind from any advertence towards the repulsive or unrepulsive objects. So one just lets the repulsive and unrepulsive go their own way and draws the mind in and focuses upon an inward object. For example, one way to do this, if one is in the midst of repulsive, unrepulsive objects and the attractive objects are drawing your attention, the repulsive objects are causing you to become disturbed and distressed, you withdraw the attention from both of them and focus upon maybe the touch of the breath as you're breathing in and out. Or if you're walking, you could focus on the touch sensation of your feet against the ground. Or if you're standing still, just focus upon the sensation of the body in the standing posture. Or just draw the mind in and focus upon a purely internal object. For example, if you're experienced doing recollection or mindfulness of the Buddha, you can bring the image of the Buddha to mind and draw the mind inward with equanimity, mindful, clearly comprehending, and don't pay attention to the outer attractive and unattractive objects. Okay, and that is how, the Buddha says, that is how one is a noble one with developed faculties. And then summing up, the Buddha says, and so, Ananda, the supreme development of the faculties in the noble one's discipline has been taught by me. The disciple in higher training who has entered upon the way has been taught by me, and the noble one with developed faculties has been taught by me. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare, that I have done for you, Ananda. Here are the roots of trees. Here are empty huts. Meditate, Ananda. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. I think the compilers put that at the very end of the Majjhima Nikaya as a kind of word of encouragement and instruction to the monks. Okay, we have a few minutes left in case there are any questions. Okay, Dina. Dina?
Sometimes the repulsive is dangerous. And yeah. How do you... Donald Trump comes to mind. No. No, how do you then find equanimity? You're in the face of a naga, it turns out, might be a snake, right?
Oh, of course one has to apply clear comprehension and wise judgment to the situation.
So you bring judgment into the picture.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You don't just
definitely,
keep striving for equanimity.
Oh, no, certainly. Certainly one has to bring judgment.
In fact, thank you.
Since you bring up that example, there's a passage. It's in Sutta number 2 in the Majjhima Nikaya. The Buddha speaks about how certain troubles are to be avoided overcome or eliminated by avoidance. And he mentions the case of if one sees a wild horse, a wild dog, a wild elephant, then one avoids it. Yeah, so one has to, how to apply. One applies wisdom to the situation, and if one sees we don't see wild elephants here, but a dangerous snake crossing the path, one doesn't just continue walking across the path thinking I'm going to maintain my equanimity, but one waits until the snake gets across or one takes another path.
I'm sorry, but it gets tricky because then you bring judgment into it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, sometimes the repulsive might not be dangerous, but you perceive it that way. It's a little complicated in my mind, but you understand.
There's no set of rules which is perfectly applicable in all details to every situation. Okay, Michael, and then I think Suki is in the back. Yeah, Michael.
But actually, on the same note, I'm troubled by the idea that the idea that I think I'm hearing, that we're putting equanimity aside.
That we're putting.
We're putting equanimity aside as the poisonous snake crosses our path. We're going into a different non-equanimous mode, and then after the snake is gone, we're back into equanimity.
No. One is not putting equanimity aside. One still maintains the equanimity while waiting for the snake to cross the path. It's just that one doesn't undertake the foolish action of walking across the path while the snake's movement is not completely clear and one might endanger oneself.
Okay, so we're making a judgment. If the judgment we're making is to not walk, step on a poisonous snake,
yeah,
that's the judgment. So so we're maintaining our equanimity throughout the entire process.
Yeah. One is maintaining the equanimity, but one is just using, against that background of equanimity, one is deciding which situations should be avoided and which situations in which no avoidance is necessary.
Thank you.
I saw Suki had her hand up in the back.
Ante, about the manapa, amanapa, agreeable, disagreeable. You said elsewhere it's all like qualities of the object.
Yeah.
And inside me, I said, "Oh, I don't agree." in object itself, there's no. I kind of fear there's no such thing agreeable or not agreeable. It all comes from your feeling, your concept,
your mental mind. Evaluation.
Right. So you know, I need a little more explanation. It bothers me a little bit.
Actually, the texts seem to be using what I would call what you say is true, but the texts use these words like likable, agreeable, pleasurable. In regard to the objects themselves, I think what they do is to use the common standard in the world or the prevalent opinion in the world about what is considered agreeable, disagreeable, likable, and unlikable. But as you say, the objects themselves are just objects. And you know, to overcome the liking and disliking, that's one of the modes of contemplation one can use, that liking and disliking come from the mind. And so when one has that thought, you know, one can eat yeah, just this past week, I had the experience of eating something. It's a Chinese delicacy. It's called stinky tofu. And when it's served on the table, the immediate reaction is, what are they doing? Trying to poison me? Maybe it's a little bit like, even like the Korean kimchi. Yes. When Westerners are first exposed to it, you know, their reaction is, what is this? Terrible. But through once you get acquainted with it, then it can become likable. I think I'm getting messages from both left and right that it's time to break. Okay, so we'll stop now and then come back maybe 12:15 for discussion period. Okay, so let us end by sharing the merits with the devas, the nagas, the dragon spirits, not necessarily with the naked ascetics. And yeah, large elephants and cobras are also called nagas. Okay, so we'll share the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mang Param Eta Vatacham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Deva Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Eta Vatacham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Bhuta Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Eta vatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sat anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya pavagupadaya avichihetato etanta re satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, so we do three half bows to the Buddha. Okay, one, two, three.